Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News. I'm Max Scott.
And I am Susie Alvarez.
From CKLN and the G20 Alternative Media Center, we bring you Groundwire Goes to the G20, the first of two editions with features on global issues from the G20 summit.
In this edition,
the state has very little control over who ends up getting injured.
We want Canada to recommend abroad that all these countries that have signed the rights of women live up to what they have signed.
And the economic realm is one of the most important parts of our lives, and we need to reclaim it.
But first, the national headlines. For a small group of Christian Aboriginal leaders, the time has come to publicly forgive the Canadian government for the abuse suffered by First Nations, Inuit, and Métis children in church-run residential schools. Kenny Blacksmith, the founder of Gathering Nations International, a former chief of the Cree community of Mitissini in northern Quebec, says, quote, "We've experienced the power of forgiveness, and we want forgiveness as a way of life from here on," end quote.
Though the federal apology was issued 2 years ago, the group now wants to honor Harper with a ceremonial chief's headdress, which many First Nations people have claimed is an insult. Gunnarji O'Sullivan.
I'm a First Nations woman. I was in the residential school. My mother went to the residential school. And to this day, I still see people who are losing their children. Young youth who are giving birth are losing their children to the system. So I personally do not forgive. I do not forgive because our healing fund was cut in half after the apology. And plus, I found that the residential school agreement was trickery upon my people. I do not forgive Stephen Harper, and I will never forgive. I just can't. I'm sorry.
Also this week, federal legislation that previously allowed First Nations children to be removed from their homes to residential schools has been officially removed.
Canadians are now permitted to watch Al Jazeera English, a 24-hour global news service in Canada, carried by three major broadcast distributors. However, without specifically ordering Al Jazeera, Canadians will not see the channel, except with Quebec's Vidéotron. A year ago, openmedia.ca launched a campaign urging Canadians to contact the CRTC in support of Al Jazeera English. Of the approximately 2,800 public comments submitted to the CRTC, all were in favor of Al Jazeera, except 40 parties who filed comments in opposition to bringing the broadcaster to Canada. The three major distributors now offering Al Jazeera English are Bell TV Rogers and Vidéotron. In the West, Shaw is not carrying it as of now, and TELUS and Al Jazeera are still in negotiations. Noted author A.V. Lewis spoke recently with Steve Anderson about what Al Jazeera's inclusion means for Canadian viewers.
Al Jazeera's method is to hire people from the countries where they're going to be reporting from. And for the majority of the broadcast centers to be based in the Global South, for the majority of the news bureaus to be based in the Global South, and for the Global South to have a global platform from which to tell its own stories. We don't get it right every day. There are lots of times when I'm watching Al Jazeera when, you know, I groan because I see something that I feel is kind of a news cliche or the way that things are always done. But a number of times every day, I watch the channel that I work for with tremendous pride. And I think as more Canadians get a look at what we do, I think that it'll spark a lot of really interesting conversations in Canada.
Also this week, Ottawa stands up for the Algonquin right to retain their traditional government. 30 Algonquins of Barrier Lake plus dozens of supporters gathered in Ottawa for 2 days of campaigning against the Conservative government's imposition of Indian Act Section 74. Barrier Lake is one of roughly 25 communities across the country left with their customary governance system.
Section 74 will mean replacing their traditional governance system with elections and a band council. Section 74 hasn't been imposed forcibly on a community since 1924. The Haudenosaunee Confederacy was padlocked shut and traditional chiefs were put in jail and replaced by a band council. Critics of Section 74 are calling the legislation unconstitutional and in contravention of international law. Community members see it as an act of assimilation and an attempt to sever their connection with their traditional territory.
Back home, the Conservative government, Harper, is trying to demolish our customs, trying to assimilate our community, and we are saying no to the Indian Act. No, we don't need that back home. Our customs has never been the problem. Indian Act is the problem.
Divided for many years, the Algonquin communities are now reconciling and have united against the imposition of Section 74. The violence that erupted in Tivoli Gardens, Jamaica, captured worldwide attention. Jamaican Canadians are responding to organized crime in the garrison communities where the recent clashes have taken place.
Sven Carlson reports.
Between May 24th and May 27th, clashes between the state's armed forces and civilians in the Jamaican capital of Kingston left 73 dead, a number many fear could be significantly higher. The violence predominantly occurred in the Kingston neighborhoods of Denhamtown and Tivoli Gardens. Civilians in these neighborhoods took up arms to defend gang leader Christopher Dudas Koch, whose extradition was requested by the United States in August 2009 on weapons and drugs charges. The Jamaican government stalled the search for Koch until last month. The Jamaican Canadian community has been upset by misconceptions about the geographical reach of the violence caused by mainstream media's reporting on the issue. Janice Dale, a Jamaican-Canadian journalist and radio host based in Montreal, expands on the limited geographical scope of the violence.
No different than anywhere in the world. Jamaica has different echelons of society. There are inner city areas where there are poverty and lack of education and lack of many other things. Those places often breed organized crime.
The violent clashes have called into question the historic connections between the two major political parties and organized crime, as well as how the high demand for drugs in Canada, the United States, and Europe is exacerbating the levels of violence seen in Jamaica.
Can't go in the world without opposition to your plans. I'm making it twirl around your greedy fingers. We watching it swirl down the drain. Insane economics unfurl. See, we're not buying what you're selling, even with your propaganda. Tell the media barons rebelling. We're yelling. No justice, no
peace. Now, Groundwire goes to the G20.
A better world we see, so we're free when we speak. Oil's at its peak, and we got at a beat. The status quo will keep us unable to speak. On our knees saying, please, we reap.
Welcome back to Groundwire Community Radio News.
In G20 News, the Toronto Police Union has called for Sid Ryan to resign. The president of the Ontario Federation of Labour had called on the police to assure the public they would not place agent provocateurs at the G20 protests, as had been done in Montebello, Quebec.
University of Toronto students and staff are being forced off their campus. Residents of dorms are being asked to relocate because the G20 security zone encompasses their buildings. Yet the students are only being refunded $100 for their trouble. And most puzzling, the new location is even closer to the G20. About 17 student and labor groups and 70 professors have condemned the closure and asked the university to reverse the decision. However, the administration has proceeded with the closure. Joita Gupta, VP of the Association of Part-Time Graduate Students.
Many students who are living in residence, about 500 in all, are to be moved to other locations, 89 Chestnut, which is ironically closer to the red zone, which is an affront to the argument about safety, and other students are being moved to Scarborough and UTM campuses. As such, you can expect that in the upcoming week, the downtown campus will be quite deserted. In the first half of the week, students will be scrambling to write exams that have been rescheduled. And in the second half, it's going to be pretty much shut down, with the exception of the Monk Center, which will remain open to talk about the G8 and G20. So this is an attempt by the university administration to control the discourse. And in response to that, there has been a great deal of resistance from the community. Many students have had to make different plans or change their plans because of this sudden and abrupt closure. On the point about workers, there are, in my view, two classes of workers, one that a set that are being compensated for their time off and are being paid to take the time off, and another set, particularly casualized workers who are not getting paid for the time that they're being forced to take off because of the closure. And for the skeletal staff that are essential to the university and will be required to come in. There's no provision in place to ensure that they actually have time in lieu of having to come in when other people were getting time off. So it's a really convoluted and a complicated time, but I think that it has been overall a learning experience and has forced us to really interrogate ourselves and ask about whose campus this is.
The G20 is more than sound cannons, fake lakes, and limousines. The G20 has also served as a focal point for community-based social justice movements to come together and imagine just economic alternatives. One such opportunity for dialogue was the Toronto versus the G20 teach-in, Candace Moore's report.
On Saturday, June 5th, 250 people gathered in the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education auditorium for a teach-in on the G20. The event was titled Toronto versus the G20. The first panel brought together anti-poverty activists, union organizers, and workers to talk about economic justice in Ontario.
The first is that the G20 is not coming here at the end of June. The G20 is already here, and it has been here for a long time. The second is that capitalism is an unjust system, and the only way to achieve justice is to overthrow it. And the third is that this is a part of a long-standing and ongoing struggle. There are a lot of new people that have been mobilized through this G20 organizing, and that is necessary and it is exciting. And I implore everyone to see themselves within that history and to look to the future and to look to how to continue organizing in your communities and continue building a strong fight back.
AJ Withers is a member of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. Rekha Sharma is a member of Unite Here Local 75. Her union represents over 7,000 workers in the hospitality industries.
June 24th is actually our first action at the Novotel Toronto Centre, where workers are planning rallies, pickets, work stoppages, and are going to be marching out of their workplace when the French delegates are staying at the Novotel Toronto Centre during the G20 to bring light to these issues.
On June 3rd, Unite Here at Local 75 announced that the union voted 94% in favour of a strike authorization vote. The vote sent a clear message to employers that workers are willing to go on strike if their bargaining demands are not met. Their demands include workplace safety, stable jobs, and health and welfare. Many of the employers are hotels owned by French-based company Accor.
We're actually just planning to focus right now on Accor. Accor has been having organizing drives in Morocco and Indonesia, and the French unions as well as the Brazilian unions have also decided to target Accor as a negative employer that does not respect workers' rights. The reason why Accor is set as a target is because in 1995, Accor actually signed an agreement with the International Union of Food Service Workers, saying that they will not oppose efforts for unionization in their workplaces around the world. Yet, there's only two unionized hotels in North America. There is something wrong with that picture.
Ajamu Nangwaya is a student and member of CUPE Ontario. He believes that workers represent the backbone of economic production.
I think we have to start to think about building the road as we travel. And the economic realm is one of the most important parts of our lives. And we need to reclaim it from the capitalists. We need to reclaim it from the state. But it's going to be a battle of will. And there are resources that exist in the state that we, through contestation, we can force them to finance the very system that's going to lead to their destruction, but it's going to lead means political mobilization, political education, and the willingness to work for long-term structural change in the context of this system.
For Groundwire, I'm Candace Moores, reporting in Toronto.
Thanks to Annabelle Koo and Candace Moores, CHRY 105.5 FM, for that report. And now,
there has been much play in the mainstream media over the last few weeks about the long-range acoustic device, or LRAD, that the police will be using against protesters during the G20 protest. However, activists around the world who have experienced this sound weapon argue against its effectiveness. CKUT Radio's Aaron Lakoff has more.
In late May, the Toronto police announced a new weapon which they'll be using to aid in crowd control during the G20 summit. The long-range acoustic device, or LRAD, has been dubbed a sound cannon by many. It is a high-quality speaker, generally mounted on top of a police vehicle, which can emit an extremely loud and high-pitched tone, which is far beyond the pain threshold for many. While the Toronto Police have insisted that they will only use the LRAD in short bursts, many activists are worried about the device causing long-term hearing damage. However, the LRAD may not be as effective a tool for crowd dispersal as the police would want the public to believe. It was also used against demonstrators during the G20 meetings in Pittsburgh in September of 2009. Groundwire spoke with Alex Bradley, who was a member of the Pittsburgh G20 Resistance Project. He directly experienced the LRAD on the streets of Pittsburgh last year.
For lots of other reasons, it's just not very tactically effective. You can neutralize it with cheap earplugs. It's line of sight, so it's strongest against one particular area. If they use the highest settings, you've got really, really serious risks of injuries to people. And I think the important point that is the state has very little control over who ends up getting injured. And just from a legal standpoint and kind of from a risk aversion standpoint, that's not really in the state's interest.
While the LRAD is primarily a communication device, it also has what's known as a deterrent tone capability, which emits the high-pitched scream. Bradley describes how one can easily protect oneself from this function.
There was a couple times I was at the very front of the march, so about as close as people ended up getting to the LRAD when it was being used, and simply putting your fingers over your ears was enough to stay in the area.
Groundwire also spoke with Robert Putnam, who is in charge of investor and media relations for the LRAD company, who manufacture and distribute the devices out of San Diego. Putnam was questioned on other activist claims that the LRAD can be easily neutralized if you cover your ears or wear earplugs.
Absolutely true, and that's the whole point, but they can't say they can't hear it. They still can hear the instructions, they can still hear the deterrent tone, but you're right, it doesn't hurt them. And so that's why we believe that this is not a weapon, lethal or non-lethal or anywise, it's a communications tool, it's a communications device, and people can quickly neutralize it by wearing hearing protection.
Last week, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association filed an injunction against the Toronto Police and Ontario Provincial Police in order to stop the LRAD before it is used. In the meantime, the Council of Canadians has announced that they will hand out thousands of earplugs to protesters at the G20 in Toronto. For Groundwire, this is CKUT's Aaron Lakoff reporting from Montreal.
Justice for our communities. No to the G8 G20. Wondering why they can spend $1.1 billion on this photo shoot while closing your daycare and charging you to use the local pool?
Join us.
Help us tell them this isn't their city.
For more info, visit 25june.wordpress.com.
For details on other protests scheduled throughout the week of June 21st, check out attacktheroots.net. Tune in to CKLN 88.1 FM between June 25 and 27 for G20 focused coverage and reports.
We are making revolutionary radio.
The G20 leaders, largely comprised of males, have women on their radar at the upcoming summit. But does Canada really have any business leading the charge to improve the lives of women? Across Canada, feminists are meeting to create their own visions for the advancement of women. Last week in Toronto, this magazine hosted a lively roundtable discussion with Judy Rubick. And on the West Coast, reporter Alegira Imperial attended discussions led by elders and grandmothers. Groundwire examines what the G20 women's agenda would look like if women in Canada had a hand in shaping it.
Women's voices at the table. Around 300 women and some men from various organizations gathered at the said celebration workshop, which followed a rally discussed issues related to women's rights and gender equality, culminating in recommendations and actions that women want heeded by Canadian leaders and their counterparts at the meeting. Here today to talk about them are Elsie Dean, Alice West, Marion Smith, and myself, Alegria Imperial, all members of Women Elders in Action. First, why should women's voices get to the table. Elsie?
Perhaps I should say a little bit about the G8 and G20. Heads of governments of the richest 8 countries in the world and the richest 20 countries in the world, they get together and start to talk about how the world should be run, basically. And the objection that we feel is that we don't have any say. The ordinary people don't have any say because they meet behind closed doors. They do everything in secret. We don't know what their plan. They will not allow any observers, or very few, and they usually choose them. They decide whether there will be money for child care, for health, for pensions, care of seniors. All of these things are affected after these particular gatherings of the G8 and the G20. Discussion should be open, where you can listen to them and understand what is being done. It is our world, it is our resources, and we should know. So the women have, at least we're going to send resolutions to them. We'll send it to our government, and somehow we're going to have to check up and make sure that they raise these issues. With that, Alice, you were going to talk about some of the resolutions and discussion on a few of the issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think we have to look at what the state of women in the world is today. And one obvious, very blatant fact comes straightforward to us is the fact that so many women live in poverty. Actually, 70% of the world's poor are women. And that includes Canada, because we do have a poverty issue here in Canada as well. British Columbia in particular, for 6 years in a row, has had the highest child poverty rate in Canada. And the recommendation was that Canada should adopt a guaranteed livable income, and that makes sure that no individual spends more than 50% of his or her income on housing, food, and clothing and childcare. And childcare is a very important issue in this. And it was also recommended that the government implement a national housing strategy that guarantees safe, affordable, sustainable housing for all. Now, this seems almost like an impossible dream, because it's been something that women have been fighting for years. We have to concentrate on, and we have to be sure that our governments are aware of what's happening to the ordinary person.
Well, this is Marion. I sat at the table for discussing violence against women, and we discussed the issues that affect mostly Canadian women. Certainly, we are aware of the violence against women in other countries, but we weren't really able to discuss that because we are all women from this country. One of the things that came out of that, and one of the recommendations that we would have made, was that men begin to take some responsibility for violence against women. And to that end, we suggested an action of working on changing societal attitudes to violence against women, and address the portrayal of women in the media and create new role models for men and women. And I sat at the housing table as well. Of course, I think that one of the issues for women being safe from violence is their housing. Our recommendations to the G8 and the G20 was to take their responsibility to provide adequate housing for each of the citizens in each of their countries, and in our country in particular, to have a national housing plan, which we lost in the 90s.
I was at the climate change and food security table. I chose it because I'm very much aware of the changes going on in food production and food distribution and marketing, and it seems to be going far, far beyond what has been natural. If farming is being taken away by huge corporations, and slowly it's been creeping into the scenario as well, where will all that wisdom go? That the federal government should contribute its fair share and support adaptation funding, which is to fund people dealing with the effects of climate change and food security. We should also encourage governments to create legislation that opposes foreign ownership of land and regulates land use. We should also encourage the Canadian government in particular to take a leadership role on this issue.
I attended the table that was discussing peace, women, and militarism. We discussed what was the monetary cost and the resource cost that we give up in order to engage in war. World Watch is now saying that we are spending in this world $2.5 trillion each year to wage war and to provide the means for waging war. So they recommended that we demand that all military ads and promotions refrain from using women and children receiving help protection as the rationale for militarism and war. Because so many women have been told, and some believe, that we have gone into Afghanistan to help the women. We also said that we would lobby MPs and MLAs to abolish military recruitment in schools and universities. One of the tables, of course, was women in solidarity, and that means women around the world working together. So we want Canada to recommend abroad that all these countries that have signed the rights of women live up to what they have signed.
This is Alegria Imperial of We Act reporting for CJSF.
And now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. This year's National Community Radio Conference was an adventure to Gabriola Island in British Columbia. It was a different kind of conference that galloped at a comfortable pace thanks to the friendly island hosts. Unusually, this year's conference was also held at a station still building itself, CKGI.
This year, the National Community Radio Conference was held on the shores just off of Vancouver, BC, on the very beautiful, remote Gabriela Island.
So how are you feeling about the conference overall, Ken?
Well, overall, the conference went well. We had three objectives in fulfilling the conference. One was that people were coming here and they could learn something, so we had to provide an environment where the sessions could be held, and everybody seemed to be responding well to that. And the other one was that people had a good time, and actually on the meet and greet, the keg broke open and was leaking beer. We were handing out pitchers, so I think a good time was had. And the third pillar for the conference was that business was undertaken. I mean, the national organization needs to undertake national business. Plenary is held at the national conference. And it ended on time, so I'd have to say that it was a success. All the business that needed to be done got done.
This conference was unique because it is the very first time the NCRC came to a station that was broadcasting temporarily and had not been granted a permanent FM license.
There was a number of firsts at the conference this year. This was the first year the conference was held in a rural setting. This is the first year the conference was held by a station that wasn't yet a station. We have yet to get our broadcast license. We're merely applying for one. And this is the first year that we had a remote presenter in order to lower the carbon footprint of the overall conference. And the big first is this the first conference that was broadcast from. And we applied for a temporary special event permit, 98.7, which we happen to know is available and open in the area.
Not only were the hosts of Gabriola Island Co-op Radio very gracious, but the whole island community of 4,000 were more than welcoming to all the guests from the NCRC. Right now we're standing here outside the patio of the Surf Lodge here on beautiful Gabriela Island. We are fortunate to have the courtesy of and this pleasure of speaking to one of the staff members here at the Surf Lodge.
Sarah Knight.
Do you remember when you first heard about the conference coming into town?
I heard about it probably around the winter time, sometime during the winter, and we were told it was going to be really busy and nobody could take time off that week. Well, it's interesting. There's people in suits and then people in, like, studded belts. So it was a whole range of people. I didn't really have any expectations. But, we knew it was going to be busy. And it's been a great crowd, though. Really easygoing. Party atmosphere, like, on jam night was really busy. And
the island, the artists per capita ratio is very high here. So there are a lot of performances you often see. There's jams happening all the time.
We're proud of our artists and our musicians, like Brad on Jam Night. We're so lucky and take advantage of how much he plays and, hosts that jam every Wednesday night. And it's nice to get more people out and experiencing it. So,
what's the general vibe been around town about having being on FM for this week?
Excited. You know, everybody was trying to tune in, and it's all on Facebook. And yeah, and I think everybody's been really supportive and good to be on the map. I think everybody wants to be on the radio. I don't know. That's how I feel. But
it was a comfortable and amiable week altogether. I got to meet a lot of people around the campfire, out at the beach, and around town. After the conference, community radio friends boarded the ferry for home. See you next year in Halifax. For Gramwell, this is Nick Panu.
And that's all for this edition of Groundwire. I've been your host, Susie Alvarez.
And I'm Max Scott. Join us for a post-G20 deconstruction on July 3rd.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. This edition produced at CKLN Community Radio in association with the G20 Alternative Media Center in Toronto.
Headlines by Annabelle Koo, Courtney Kirkby, Frida Worden, David Parker, and Jackie Tunistra Harrison. Production by Susie Alvarez.
For their support, Groundwire thanks the Canadian Union of Public Employees. Go to cupe.ca for more info, and the Public Service Alliance of Canada. Think public and visit psac.com.